Good afternoon. I'd like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, March 3rd, and let the record reflect it is 1 p.m. Today we have present Representative Johnson, Representative Groh, Representative Carpenter, Representative Gray, and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Sophia Tenney with House Records and Sydney Truitt with Juvenile LAO. Thank you for your work. On today's agenda, the committee will bring back House Bill 66, Controlled Substances, from the governor, as presented by the Criminal Division of the Department of Law in its third hearing. We will also hear House Bill 67, concerning harassment of sex offenders, and this is a bill by the governor and presented by the Criminal Division of the Department of Law in its first hearing. So we will now take up House Bill 66. And I'd like to welcome to the table Department of Law Criminal Division Director, Mr. John Skidmore. Welcome. Please state your name for the record. And if you would just give us a quick reminder of what this bill is about, and then we will hear from your invited testimony.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the Alaska Department of Law. House Bill 66 in front of you is the bill that addresses changing the classification for when a drug dealer provides drugs to another person that results in their death. It moves it from manslaughter to murder in the second degree. It also places some restrictions on the ability to get good time for those individuals that have been convicted of distributing certain types of drugs, classes 1 through 4.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. So I believe we have online Ms. Sandy Snodgrass from the Alaska Fentanyl Response. If you would state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Judiciary Committee, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Sandy Snodgrass. I'm the founder of AK Fentanyl Response Project, and my only child, Robert Bruce Snodgrass, was poisoned to death on October 26, 2021, in Anchorage, Alaska. He was 22 years old. His death at that time was classified as an accidental overdose, and I believe that should have been classified as a drug-induced homicide and prosecuted as second-degree murder. My son received 100% fentanyl that day. I don't believe he was seeking fentanyl. Under those conditions, I consider what happened to my son a poisoning, not an accidental overdose, and that he was murdered. Moving forward with the passage of HB 66, drug dealers that knowingly or unknowingly cause a death, a second-degree murder charge, I believe, is the appropriate charge under those circumstances. This act will serve as a deterrent to individuals and that any individuals that are dealing in illicit drugs. This act will enable law enforcement and district attorneys to go negotiate lower level drug dealers to give up their higher level associates, which I believe is very, very important, especially specifically when we're talking about fentanyl. We are not talking about substance abuse disorder individuals in our community be prosecuted for second degree murder. The intent of this bill is to reach higher level drug dealers, particularly those that are bringing these deadly poisons into our state at alarming records. I believe this act will demonstrate to Alaskans that their leaders are taking action to protect our state and punish perpetrators who are poisoning members of our community. This issue is not only affecting urban communities. Cartel members are purposely targeting our Alaskan villages to maximize product, the profits that they're able to make in rural villages with complete disregard for human life. We together must stem the surge that fentanyl is wreaking on our beloved state of Alaska. I strongly encourage the members of this committee to advance HB 66 to the Finance Committee. We need our leaders to stand up and respond to the fentanyl epidemic in Alaska. So AK Fentanyl Response Project I look at it as a three-legged stool approach to this epidemic. One of the legs of the stool is AK Fentanyl Response Project, which provides prevention, awareness, and education to Alaskan communities, including schools, hopefully more schools, the sooner the better. This bill stands another leg of the stool, which is the law enforcement leg, we know that our state troopers, our DEA agents, our HIDTA initiatives are working tirelessly to interdict and arrest perpetrators. This bill will enable those arrests to really have some teeth in them with a second-degree murder charge and hopefully convictions. The third leg of the stool is providing substance abuse treatment to individuals that are diagnosed with a substance abuse disorder. The problem with fentanyl, as was the case with my child, is fentanyl killed my child before he had the ability to enter long-term recovery. It's imperative that we press on all three legs of the stool, otherwise the stool falls over. So this bill will put a lot of pressure on the law enforcement stool. I plan to put pressure on the education, leg, and many things are happening around the state to provide treatment for those who need it. I appreciate the time today. If you have any follow-up questions, I'm happy to provide those. I will stay on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Snodgrass, for your testimony and our condolences for the loss of your son. I'd like to let the record reflect that we were joined by Representative Eastman at 1:02 p.m. Do we have any questions for Ms. Snodgrass from the committee members? Thank you, Ms. Snodgrass, for your testimony, and we look forward to seeing your continued work.
Thank you.
I will now open public testimony for House Bill 66. So we have people in the room who would like to come. If you have signed in, one moment. I would like to invite Mr. Mike Dundas, if I pronounced it correctly, please come to the table. State your name for the record, and you will have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Michael Dundas. I live in Juneau. Presently, I'm representing myself, and I'm here to speak against Section 2 in House Bill 66. I come from a family with strong Christian values, and I hold a welding certificate with some post-baccalaureate studies. I am also an alcohol addict, presently overcoming the struggles of addiction. If it wasn't for the treatment I have received, my vision for a way out of this struggle would still be confusing. I realized that I needed to humble myself and reach out for help and be thankful that treatment was available for me. Section 2 of HB 66 removes good time for a long list of drug-related crimes. Not everyone in this section is a murderer or a serious drug dealer. By removing the possibility of good time, you are removing the incentive to seek treatment for the people who need it the most to get better. The Department of Corrections reports that 95% of the people incarcerated today will eventually get out. Without the incentive of good time, people are more likely to sit around in prison and not get better, which means they could get worse. So when they are eventually released, they are worse off and more of a danger to society than when they went in. Is this what society wants? I want to emphasize how important the good time period means to a first-time offender. This good time period can be taken as a second chance to become a better citizen. If you remove this incentive, you are just punishing the disease, and this first-time lawbreaker may give up hope and be less likely to continue on a path of recovery. So I thank you all for taking the time to hear my testimony today.
Thank you for your testimony. You can submit a copy of that that will be provided for the written record if you like. Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Thomas Morris. Please state your name for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Thomas Norris. I am 32 years old and currently residing here in Juneau. I am an addict in recovery, and I am here representing myself as well as human beings that struggle with addiction. I am here to speak against Section 2 of House Bill 66. I am stepping forward to speak today as a man in recovery who has made some bad choices in my past that I regret wholeheartedly. I believe that there are three major things that can deter a person who has made bad choices in their past in wanting to change and deter them from wanting to stop making those choices again. Number one, hope. Hope for having a chance to make better choices as an addict in recovery in their future at a time in their life that they have earned with good behavior. Two, support. Showing an addict that has made a mistake that you are there to help them rehabilitate themselves and offer them a chance at changing and living a better life rather than giving up on them and giving them a reason to believe that they are a monster that can't be saved rather than a human being that has made a mistake. Three, being labeled. If an addict feels as if they are labeled by others as being a monster with no hope or support from others in their ability to change, why would they ever want to? I am here right now fighting for hope and support for those addicts who are human beings that do not deserve to be judged as monsters. I do not believe that an addict should be locked away like a monster that doesn't deserve to get help or enjoy a family dinner with their loved ones at an earlier time for performing good behavior in a very difficult environment. So please give hope, offer support, and please help fight the stigma for these human beings that are struggling with addiction as being monsters. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. Next we have Brenda Stanville? Nope. My apologies, I didn't read the rest of the list. So is there anyone else in the room seeking to testify? Thank you. I will now go on to testimony online. Brief at ease. Record. We have no one available online, so I am now going to close public testimony for House Bill 66. For those listening online who wish to provide their testimony on this bill, you can email it to house.judiciary@akleg.gov, and it will be uploaded on the legislative website for the record. I will now set House Bill 66 aside, and as a reminder to the committee, we will take up amendments and consider passage of this bill on Monday, March 6th at 1:30 p.m. For our final agenda item today, we will hear House Bill 67 concerning harassment of sex offenders and offenses from the governor as presented by the Criminal Division of the Department of Law in its first hearing. I'd like to welcome Mr. John Skidmore back to the table. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, members of House Judiciary. Again, for the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Alaska Department of Law. You have in front of you HB 67. This bill is designed to protect children and victims. It really does five things, and I'm going to go through each of those five individually. First, it removes incentives for sex offenders from out of state to be relocating to Alaska to avoid sex offender registry requirements in their home state. Second, it helps law enforcement personnel better monitor the activities of sex offenders within our state by adding some additional details required under the sex offender registry. Next, it also provides appropriate grouping of protective orders when it comes to stalking offenses. That's a more complicated explanation that I'll get into when I discuss stalking here in just a few moments. After that, it addresses those individuals that are repeat violators for violations of conditions of release, ensuring that there are some sanctions when there are repeated violations. Then it also addresses situations in which we have young offenders under the age of 13 that engage in sexual contact or sexual penetration with other children under the age of 13, ensuring that both the victims and the defendants can be talked to by what are referred to as child advocacy centers, multidisciplinary teams that address the needs of the children. And then last but not least, it also ensures that we reduce trauma and protect victims by allowing officers or others to summarize information at grand jury and not forcing victims to have to testify again. So those are the things we're going to go through. Let me start with what I started with a few moments ago, and that's the Sex Offender Registry. You all may or may not recall that previously Alaska had changed our sex offender registration laws in 2019. This was because in 2018, we had a case from the Alaska Supreme Court, one of the Doe cases. This one in 2018 indicated that Alaska needed to follow what is called the categorical analytical approach. What that means is that in Alaska, to determine whether or not somebody needed to register as a sex offender, we would compare the elements of another state's statutes to the elements of Alaska statutes that require registry. And only if the elements of the two statutes were similar would someone be required to register. Let me explain why that's problematic. If you have another state, for example, that deals with sexual contact, and they define sexual contact as touching genitals, female breasts, or anus, and that was all they described, that would be consistent with Alaska's laws. But if they define sexual contact beyond that to include, say, for instance, the inner thigh, or some other part of the human body, that would not be substantially similar, and that person would not be required to register because the statutes were different. Now, here's the kicker. Even if the conduct that the person had engaged in was touching the genitals of another person in their state, that's the conduct for which they were convicted, that didn't matter. It only required us to look at the elements of the statutes, and if they were not similar, then the requirement to register would not be there. The Alaska legislature in 2019 did not like that approach. They passed a law that said if you have to register in your state, you'll have to register in our state. However, when that law was passed so that it was applied prospectively to the date of the conviction. Meaning, when it was passed in 2019, only if the conviction occurred after the date of the passage, the effective date of that bill, would that requirement be in effect. Otherwise, we were still under the categorical approach, which means that for all those individuals that were convicted of sex offenses in a different state prior to 2019, we are still applying that old format that we did not want to be applying. How does this impact Alaska? Well, there are currently approximately 500 individuals in our state for whom would not need to register, even though they were convicted as sex offenders in another state, or that the Department of Law is currently having to go back and review the statutes between the two states to determine if they should be removed from the registry. And so what this bill does, what HB 67 does, is it says that determination, that requirement of if you have to register in your state, you have to register in our state, that would be applied retroactively as it applies to the date of conviction. It's a fairly simple, straightforward concept, but one that is fairly important. I can tell you this because I supervise the attorneys that have to review all of those cases, and there are over 400 of them that we're having to review right now to determine which approach is the right one to be doing. This is something that creates efficiencies, it provides clear guidance, and most importantly, it eliminates Alaska as a place for people to move to avoid registration requirements when they've been convicted in another state of an offense that required registration in that other offense, in that other state, excuse me. The second thing it does as it relates to sex offender registry is that it also brings the Alaska registration requirements in closer sync with the federal government and other states. Let me give you some examples. Right now in our state, we say that the sex offender has to tell us their name. It does not say they have to tell us their full name. Right now, we don't require that they provide their social security number. We don't require that they have to provide a passport. We don't require that they have to tell us the address of the employer and the name of the employer or the job title. It simply says you have to tell us if you're employed and where, the name of the place. It does, our current registry does not require sex offenders to tell us about temporary lodging if they change the place that they are residing at. It does not require a sex offender to provide notice if they plan to leave the state, if they plan to leave the country. All of these are the sorts of requirements that the federal government and a number of other states require of sex offenders, and this bill simply says those types of requirements should also be found here in Alaska. So that's what it does in relation to sex offender registry. The next area that I'm going to move on to is stalking. So let's talk about the crime of stalking for just a moment to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about. Stalking in the second degree, a Class A misdemeanor, occurs when there is a course of conduct that the individual knowingly engages in that recklessly places another person in fear of death or physical injury, either to themselves or some member of their family. So what that means is a course of conduct is two or more instances of unwanted conduct that places somebody in fear. That's how you commit the crime of stalking in the second degree. It's only elevated to stalking in the first degree, which goes from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony, if they have violated certain court orders, like a condition of probation, a condition of parole, a condition of release pretrial, or a domestic violence protective order, which is found in Alaska statutes 1866-100 through 180. What is not included within those groups of court orders that if they're violated, it's elevated to that next level are protective orders that apply to sexual assault or protective orders that apply to, of all things, stalking. If you've engaged in stalking behavior and there's a protective order against you and you continue to engage in stalking behavior in violation of that protective order against stalking, it is still simply stalking in the second degree. So the protective orders for both stalking and sexual assault should be receiving the same sort of protections as do the protective orders for domestic violence. And this bill would simply include those two types of protective orders along with the protective orders for domestic violence. The next thing that the bill addresses is what I talked about just a few moments ago, which are the child advocacy centers. If you're not familiar with a child advocacy center, what that is, it is a group of multidisciplinary professionals, prosecution, law enforcement, social services, people that come together to talk with children about traumatic things that may have occurred to them. This is done in a setting that is more conducive to a child to engage in those conversations. It is done by people that are specially trained to talk to children so that you don't lead the child in terms of any answers, but instead they're able to communicate in their own language simply what had happened to them. And when these interviews are conducted, they are generally recorded as well, videotaped. The problem with child advocacy centers right now is that they are only authorized in statute to engage when there is a potential prosecution, whether in the adult world or in the juvenile world. And what that leaves out is those situations in which you have an offender under the age of 13 who's engaged in sexual contact or sexual penetration with another child under the age of 13. And in those instances, those children, as much as anyone else, is in need of the child advocacy center's services to talk with them, to find out what's happened, and to make recommendations about what those children should receive in terms of services. This bill simply amends the authority for those centers to be able to speak with those children and to help direct them to the appropriate services. The next thing that I wanted to talk about then is violation of conditions of release. So currently in Alaska, if you are charged with a crime, the court then evaluates the conditions upon which you could or could not be released from custody. When they do that, they set certain conditions that you're required to follow. This is the predominant method of folks being held, or I should say the predominant method of individuals awaiting trial. They're not in custody, they're out in the community, and there are certain conditions set that they need to follow. That's appropriate. There's nothing wrong with that. The challenges we face, however, is that when someone violates those conditions of release, that's a crime in the state of Alaska. Unfortunately, what we have found all too often is that when they violate conditions, they get released back out into the community again, and there's a subsequent violation of conditions of release. Now, this is a complex and difficult problem in terms of who should be held in custody and who should not. And I am not here to offer opinions or suggest that anything be adjusted in terms of the decisions that are made about who is released and who isn't. What I am, however, here to advocate for and what the bill proposes is that when there are multiple violations of conditions of release for which someone is convicted, those sentences should not all be run concurrently. You committed offense on day one, you get brought back into the court, you're released. You commit another offense on day 10, you're brought back into court, you're released. You commit another offense on day 15. Whatever the time frame is, I'm using hypotheticals here, whatever the time frame is, when you have those multiple instances of violations, they should not all be treated as just one continuing course of conduct for which one single sentence is imposed, which is essentially what happens when you have sentences that run concurrently. So what the bill proposes is that when there are multiple convictions for violation of conditions of release, some portion of the sentence for each subsequent conviction must be run concurrently. It does not require that all of it be run concurrently. It requires some portion of it. That can be as little as one day. The point, though, is that there should be some additional sanction for those subsequent violations. That's what the bill is proposing. That's what we would recommend. I can tell you we have seen instances in which we have had sentences run concurrently for those multiple violations. That's the reason to appear in front of you all and to ask that you all exercise your policy decision-making authority to determine whether or not you agree with us that some additional time is appropriate when there are those subsequent violations. Then last but not least, the bill also addresses victims and when victims need to appear in court to pursue justice. And what I mean by that is that in a case when someone has a crime committed against them, law enforcement will investigate that crime. They will come and talk to them. They'll take a statement from them. What happens in Alaska, which is not typical in most other states, is that in Alaska, we record almost every single interview that is done with a victim or a witness. We're required by law to record all conversations with defendants when they're in custody. But we go beyond that. We record even most of them when they are with a victim or a witness. So there was legislation a number of years ago when Senator Hollis French was here in the building. And as a former prosecutor who had prosecuted sexual abuse of minor cases, he was offended by the notion that young children were called into grand jury after they've been through that CAC process that I described to you just earlier. That is, they come in, they're interviewed in an appropriate setting, it's all videotaped, it's recorded. And he thought playing that videotape at grand jury made sense so that the child didn't need to come in and describe this incident all over again. And instead of following those gold standards of having the child testify or provide a statement in a setting that's conducive to the child to be there, that's not alarming or intimidating to them, instead, they're brought into a grand jury. It's a very formal process. 12 to 18 adults whom they've never met before. And they're now having to describe this horrible traumatic event or events that had occurred to them. Why? It's not needed. The U.S. government requires grand juries, but they allow officers to summarize the information that they received when presenting the information to the grand jury. What's the purpose of the grand jury? They are there to assess the evidence that the state or the government has and decide, does it meet the standard of probable cause? And if there is sufficient evidence, then they return a true bill. If there's not sufficient evidence, then they say no true bill. The requirement of having the witnesses come in is not something that exists in the federal law, nor in 29 other jurisdictions. We in Alaska are in the minority. Let me repeat that. We're in the minority of what we require. And so what this proposes to do is it changes a court rule that would allow others to summarize the information, namely law enforcement officers, when they would go into grand jury of what the investigation shows. It does not require that. Prosecutors would still have the ability to say, you know what, in this case, I really think it's important for the grand jury to assess someone's credibility. Or I really think there's some questions that maybe law enforcement didn't ask, but that's important to be asked in the process of this. And so witnesses could still be brought to grand jury, but there would be the ability to simply have it summarized. That's the last thing that the bill does. It's a proposal that makes sense, particularly at times when we are. Not only does that protect victims, but it also helps us address situations like the backlogs that we see in our criminal justice system right now. Grand juries, when you have to call all of those witnesses, unfortunately take a much longer period of time. And we are looking for any efficiencies that we can find, because those are the ways that we make sure that our criminal justice system can work more effectively. With that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Questions from members? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Through the chair. So it surprises me a great deal that given the political sensitivity of the matter, you did not address Section 1 of the bill. Could you please address Section 1 of the bill? Or if you did, I missed it.
Section 1 of the bill, and for clarification, there is the opportunity for a sectional as well. That'll be done by Ms. Schroeder. But Section 1 of the bill is legislative findings and intents that really address overturning that previous state court case, State v. Powell. I apologize if I didn't call out Powell specifically, but I had indicated that Hollis French had passed a law that would allow testimony to be presented in grand jury through the recorded statement of the witness. And what Powell did is Powell indicated that that type of recording was not going to be allowed at grand juries. And so this would allow that to occur once again. I apologize if I didn't expressly call out Powell, but that's what Section 1 refers to.
Follow up?
Yeah,
I see on page 1, line 11 of Section 1, where it states, legislative finding that it is not now, nor has it ever been. And that's unique language. Why is that language in the bill? What is it that was interpreted or misinterpreted in the past that we're trying to go back and scrub? It's usually the reason I see that language.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, thank you for the question. And the reason that that's in there is because you had the bill that was passed by Senator French, was signed into law, and had been effective for quite some period of time. The state has been presenting cases using that video testimony of those children at grand jury instead of calling the child, using that video testimony. And when Powell said, no, that's not really what that bill meant, we believe Powell actually has it wrong. That is precisely what the legislature meant. And what we are seeking to do is to not only allow the use of that type of information going forward, but to also help us protect those instances in which those recordings have been used in the past. Because without that, what would actually happen is the courts would say, that particular grand jury proceeding, that was flawed. And that's a basis to overturn the conviction. Even if the case has now moved forward and gone to trial, and the child came into trial and testified at trial and was subject to cross-examination by the defense attorney, and the jury heard all of that, and they said, nope, we believe that's the basis for a conviction. If Powell stands, then what happens is those cases can be overturned. And those victims would then have to come back to trial again and have to testify a second time. And from our perspective, we don't think that's what's actually needed, because we believe the legislative history was fairly clear as to what the legislature was intending to accomplish when Hollis French presented that bill previously.
Follow-up?
So I see in section or subsection B of again, Section 1, where we're being asked to make another finding dealing with the legislature further finds that evidence is generally admissible at grand jury as long as the prosecutor believes the evidence will be admissible at the time of trial. And I'm just wondering, why is this language coming in, and how might that impact evidence being presented to a grand jury or attempted to present to a grand jury where there's not a prosecutor that's signing off on that evidence going before the grand jury? Or if there is a prosecutor involved, maybe it's information that's incriminating against the prosecutor, in which case the prosecutor might not want to sign off on believing that it would be admissible or something. If there's a situation where a prosecutor is not signing off on evidence going before a grand jury, wouldn't this language basically say that no one can present that information before a grand jury?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the purpose of the language there is to indicate that prosecutors should not be presenting evidence at the grand jury that would not be admissible at trial. We still want to ensure that grand juries, when they're evaluating whether or not there is probable cause, are only listening to evidence that would be admissible at trial. Because if they're listening to evidence that's not admissible at trial, then how are they truly assessing the strength of that particular case? So that's the first part of why it's there. The second part of your question, though, goes to whether or not the evidence, I think your statement was incriminating against the prosecutor. And I want to be clear, there are sort of two subcategories here. One is if the information is exculpatory, that is helping the defendant, that's still a requirement that that information be presented to grand jury. But I don't think that's what you're talking about. I think you're talking about a situation in which a prosecutor is the potential target or subject of the grand jury, in which case it would be wholly inappropriate for that prosecutor to be presenting that grand jury. It would need to be a different prosecutor that presented the grand jury. And as to the last part of your question of would a prosecutor always be there, the answer is if a grand jury is considering the authorization or the filing of an indictment, yes, a prosecutor needs to be there to provide legal advice to the grand jury about that matter.
I might expect to see some type of exception for situations where an advisory prosecutor is not necessarily the one who has initiated the information come before a grand jury, and it's somewhat troubling that that exception doesn't appear here in Section 1. Does that exception appear somewhere else in statute or another part of the bill just to make sure that evidence can come before a grand jury even if there isn't a prosecutor that, you know, is wanting it to?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the responsibility of the prosecutor is to ensure that the evidence is admissible at trial. It's not a matter of whether the prosecutor wants evidence or doesn't want evidence. It's about whether or not it meets the evidentiary standard of being admissible at trial. That's what the legal advisor is doing for a grand jury whenever there is a grand jury, and the legal advisor is the prosecutor. So you talk about a special prosecutor, that would apply then to the special prosecutor. It's whatever prosecutor is at the grand jury advising them, their responsibility is to ensure that the evidence is admissible at trial, and that's a legal determination, not a want or desire of the prosecutor.
Thank you. This seems very disturbing, but I'll hold on for the questions for now.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two quick questions about Section 5, and then I have a line of questions just about court rule changes. If it's okay, I'll just knock out the Section 5 questions real quick.
Go ahead.
Thanks. So about Section 5, and that's about the need for sex offenders convicted in other states, something that maybe isn't required here, to still register here. And it's my understanding that in Texas, public urination sometimes requires a sexual offender registration. So would it be, just so I understand the rule correctly, people convicted of public urination in Texas would need to be on the sex offender registry in Alaska?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, I can't tell you what they're required to register as a sex offender in Texas. I can tell you that, for instance, we have crimes for public indecency, which is generally when one's exposing their genitals to somebody else. I don't know if that's what's being applied, because when you talk about public urination, if it's somewhere where nobody can see the person exposing themselves, that certainly would be troubling that Texas would want those people to register. But if it's where they've exposed themselves, then that's very similar to what we have. But specifically to answer your question, it's a very simple standard. If you have to register in the other state, you would have to register if you moved here.
Yes. So you talked about how we don't have anything about touching the inner thigh, for example. You use that as an example. Why, if we want somebody who's convicted of touching the inner thigh in another state to register as a sex offender here, why don't we just amend our law to say that touching the inner thigh is a crime? Why don't we just make it so that these crimes in other states that we would like them to register for here, why don't we make that a crime here?
through the chair, Representative Gray, there are 50 different states with 50 different approaches sometimes to how they approach some sex offenses. And trying to ensure that every state's statute is identical is impossible. And as states then amend their statutes, that would require us to constantly be monitoring how any other state had amended their statutes, and then we would have to amend it. And what do you do if you have two states that are inconsistent with one another in terms of what they're doing? The concept is not about we want to criminalize the conduct that everybody else wants to criminalize. Your example of Texas, for example. If they truly are saying to someone, you have to register as a sex offender for public urination, I don't know that public urination in and of itself is a crime in Alaska, but if they're required to register, we don't want someone moving here to avoid registration requirements. That's all the statute's doing. It's not changing our criminal conduct. It's not requiring our statutes to look like every other state's for what they criminalize. We're simply saying, if you have to register there, you would need to register here if you move. That's it.
I'd like to move on to Section 12. So, and I think some of these might be directed to the court system. Madam Chair, we talked about that, but I'll just go ahead and start. So does the court system currently have a process for changing court rules?
Yes.
What is the court system's process for changing a court rule? Can I have?
Perhaps we, are you finished with questions with Mr. Skidmore? Or we ask Ms. Mead to come to the table?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Ms. Mead, are you prepared to come and answer questions about court rule changes? Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. I think we will probably need you in a few moments.
I won't be leaving.
Thank you, Ms. Mead, for being available. And please state your name for the record.
Thank you for the record. Nancy Mead, General Counsel to the Alaska Court System. And I would be happy to answer questions.
Representative Gray.
Through the chair, what is the court system's process for changing a court rule?
For court rules other than administrative rules, the court has a rule called rulemaking, and the court appoints a committee for the different areas. For example, there is a criminal rules committee, a civil rules committee, an appellate rules committee, child in need of aid rules committee. Those committees meet anywhere from 4 to 6 times a year. We have on staff a court rules attorney whose full-time job is to keep track of those meetings, take minutes. Those committees are comprised of a mix of people who are well-respected attorneys and others in the subject matter who discuss proposals. Proposals can come from anywhere. And then those committees make recommendations to the Supreme Court, which is the entity that can adopt rule changes or decline to adopt rule changes, or might say to the committee, thank you, go back and study this other area, or something along those lines. And then those rule changes can be adopted by Supreme Court order. And those are the rules of practice and procedure in the courts.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. Follow up. So in Section 12, there's a direct court rule amendment. Has this proposed rule change been brought to the committee?
This has not been brought through the chair to Representative Gray. This has not been reviewed or considered by the Criminal Rules Committee.
Follow up.
So my understanding is that the legislature can change court rules. Is there a difference in the way that past legislative court rule changes have happened and the one proposed in this bill?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Gray, and I've said this before, the Constitution says that the court sets its own rules of practice and procedure, and that's the process I just described. It also says the legislature has the right to amend those rules of practice and procedure with a 2/3 majority vote. So that has happened, and it happens probably in a legislative session. I see, you know, 2 to 4 of those each legislature. And I think what you're probably getting it at is this is different from what has happened in the past, in that the legislature, in the course of changing a substantive law, has usually led legal, tells the drafter, by the way, this touches a court rule, so I'm going to add that court rule change in here. And then sometimes the sponsor doesn't necessarily like that because it does take the two-thirds, but that's my understanding of how it's gone in the past. This is different. This is a change to a court rule that is not a consequence of a law change that you're making elsewhere in the bill. This is a more direct reach by the legislature into the process of changing rules. And I must say again, the legislature is permitted by the Constitution to change rules. This is different from what has happened historically, but I'm not saying it's unconstitutional.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Court Rule 6 already allows hearsay in certain cases. Can you just explain what hearsay is?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, we probably spend months and months in law school studying the definition of hearsay, but very generally, it's considered a statement made out of court that's used in court to prove the truth of what that statement is. The general rule in American jurisprudence is hearsay, since it is considered not reliable in and of itself in most circumstances, is not allowed at trials. Having said that, there are then a list of exceptions, and those are things that might be said out of court that you can use in court because there is some indication of reliability. The one I always think of is the excited utterance. If somebody yells, Joe just shot Sarah, that's out of court to prove that Joe is the shooter. But that might be admitted in court as an exception because it was so excited and uttered in the spur of the moment that it indicates it's probably truthful. Whereas 2 weeks later, if somebody said Joe shot Sarah, that would be inadmissible hearsay because it doesn't have that indication of reliability from what's called the excited utterance, literally called that. So there are exceptions to the hearsay rule, but in many exceptions. So that's what hearsay is, Representative Gray.
Thanks. I have one more follow-up, but I can I follow up with Mr. Skidmore? I'm sorry.
Before you do that, I want to open up to other members if they have any questions for Ms. Mead. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, does the constitutional authority granted the court to create its own rules also authorize the court to create rules that are in contradiction to statute, or do the rules have to follow statute?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, the rules and the statutes are related, certainly, but there's a lot of discussion about the difference between substance and procedure. So it's the legislature that creates substantive law, and the court, which creates the procedures for effectuating those substantive laws. So if there are, for example, certain rules that do conflict with legislation, but the reason for that would be, and the reason that would be permissible, is if the legislature did something procedural. Procedures are basically for the court to decide. Substantive law is for the legislature to decide. So if you say in a statute, if you say something in a statute that is procedural, the court could change that via court rule. And I'm not sure if I've responded to your question sufficiently.
Follow up?
Thank you. I guess what I don't think you meant to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the court rules would change the statute or be applicable instead of what the statute says.
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, on a procedural matter, that could happen. I can think of one statute which says if you want to, I'll be explicit. The statute says if you want to bump a judge, is what we call, challenge the judge in the first 5 days of any case, a party can have the judge removed for no reason at all and get a different judge. the statute says that you must file an affidavit with the court within 5 days, and it might even say, and I may be incorrect on this, something along an affidavit with the reasons therefore. The court changed that affidavit requirement because it's procedural and has a different process for doing that. So the substance is adhered to because that's what the what this legislature has the ability to speak to. The specific procedure, which is a court issue, was altered in court rule, and it's the process in the court rule that has precedence.
Follow up?
I guess my last follow up would be, what would be the process if a court rule and a statute conflict with each other? Who decides which rule or statute is the thing that we're going to follow?
Through the chair, I'm not aware of such a situation, but if it's procedure, the court would apply its own procedures. I suppose somebody could sue and say, no, the statute has priority. That is, and there are lawsuits on the difference between substance and procedure in those instances. So I think that's how that would be resolved. And then to clarify through the chair, in section 12, the court rule amendment here that is proposed by the administration, I'm not seeing that there is a conflict with a substantive law. So that's why I'm speaking hypothetically.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And I just want to thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make sure I understood you. You didn't see anything in this court rule change that would be procedural? Did I understand that correctly?
Through the chair, to Representative Johnson, if that's what I said, I misspoke. This is a procedural rule, and that's why it's in the court rules. Mm-hmm. But I don't see a conflict with a substantive law that exists. So I guess I was saying that the questions from Representative Carpenter I perceived as hypothetical and not related to Section 12. And so that's what I meant to say. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Follow up.
So to be clear, this section is procedural, and you could accept or not accept this part as a court rule change.
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, I see what you're saying. If this were passed by the legislature with the two-thirds majority vote, this would become the court rule. The court is not interested in combat with the legislature about something like that. It would be very far-fetched if the legislature were to meet its constitutional requirement of two-thirds votes to change a court rule, that the court would act contrary to that determination by the legislature. I think it would be virtually a nil chance of that happening. And I'm not saying that that would happen. You do have the ability to do procedures by that vote. And if you achieve that, the court would not decide as a matter of comedy and respect for your branch not to follow it. That's really not going to happen.
Follow up?
I think that's it for now.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that the court has held on occasion that the legislature, as a coordinate branch of government, is entitled to determine some of its own internal procedures. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I believe it is.
And follow up, is that under the separation of powers doctrine that branch of government is basically able to determine its internal procedures?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, yes, very generally. I have seen some things in court decisions saying this is, well, it could be a political question, or that is, it, for example, and we referred to this slightly the other day, if you have rules about what goes on basis, or if you have rules about how to conduct yourselves on the floor, the court would abstain from opining in any litigation about the propriety of that because that is your branch's purview.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
And I seem to remember a case not too long ago where the court was basically saying, hey, the court itself is also a coordinate branch of government, and it should be able to determine some of its own internal procedures. Is that, I mean, obviously they are their own branch of government, and so that separation of powers doctrine would apply to them as well, would it not?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I'm not sure what you're referring to that you saw that said that, but it is the case that the court is its own branch of government and is responsible for its own internal procedures and administrative matters.
Okay, thank you very much.
Any further questions for Ms. Mead?
I do.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier, and it is in the bill, there was a mention of the state versus Powell. Can you summarize what the court's decision was in that case?
Through the chair to Representative Gray. Yes, I will probably, I'm sure Mr. Skidmore knows the case very well, and I know it a little bit less well, but I am familiar with it. So this was a case, first, let me point you to something in the bill that is, I think, important. On page 11, you will see in the direct court rule amendment, which basically provides, as Mr. Skidmore said, that hearsay is admissible at grand jury. And then all, of course, that capital letter stuff is proposed to be deleted from the rule. But you'll see starting at line 22. So the current rule says, in a prosecution for a sex offense, hearsay made by a child victim may be admitted in front of the grand jury if. And what it says is the child has to be under 10 years of age. Okay. And by the way, that was the legislature's amendment of a court rule. So in the Powell case, there was an assault, and the victim was not under 10 years of age. To my knowledge, I believe the victim was 14 years of age. So looking at this current rule, it couldn't be applied. By its terms, somebody over 14 does not fit that exception, and the child victim's recorded testimony couldn't be admitted in front of grand jury under that exception. So the argument in the Powell case centered on the hearsay rule in general. Could it be admitted in grand jury under the hearsay rule in general? And as you heard previously, there is a hearsay exception for certain recorded testimony. But the court decided that that only applied in trial, not in grand jury. We have a different provision for grand jury, but at trial, that hearsay exception, which applies for recorded statements by child victims less than 16. So the argument was, well, this one could apply to Powell because it isn't unavailable because the victim was 14. But the court said the other things in that hearsay rule can't be met. That hearsay rule was passed by the legislature with no discussion of grand jury, with only discussion of trials. And said the court, furthermore, that's obvious from the wording of that exception, because one of the requirements to have that admissible at trial is that the defense has to have been able to view it ahead of time, which does not happen with grand jury. Well, a few of the other requirements that are in that hearsay rule indicated further that the legislature hadn't intended to apply it to grand jury, and the court said if they had, they'd have again amended that grand jury rule and changed the age from 10 to 16, for example. But that didn't happen in 2015, and therefore the court said the exception isn't available at grand jury. The only exception available at grand jury is the under 10, and that doesn't apply in this case. And that was the that's how I read that case.
Follow up?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Mead, for we do have Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to Section 12, and I think this is probably both for you, Ms. Mead, and Mr. Skidmore. And it talks about the evidence which the prosecutor believes would be legally admissible at trial shall be admissible before the grand jury. Then there's a lot of language that's being deleted about hearsay, but aren't there other evidentiary questions other than hearsay that are involved here in terms of what this particular statement in this proposed legislation would for reference?
Through the chair to Representative Groh, my answer is yes, but at this point I would defer to the Department of Law. You probably know courts aren't deeply involved in grand jury proceedings. It's the prosecutor. And I understand your question, but I believe I would be overstepping my role to answer in their expert area.
Okay. Thank you. I would like to ask Mr. Skidmore about that, Madam Chair. Right.
Thank you, Ms. Mee, for being available to answer.
Thank you.
Mr. Skidmore, we welcome you back to the table.
For the record, John Skidmore. Was there a particular question you wanted me to start with, Madam Chair?
If you would pick up with Representative Groh's question.
Absolutely. Through the chair to Representative Groh, the answer to your question is yes. There are other rules of evidence that do apply that would constrain what information would be admissible at grand jury. I can provide examples if that's what you're looking for, but the simple answer is yes.
Madam Chair, follow up. Mr. Skidmore, could you give those examples that you're coming to mind?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, the first thing that comes to mind is relevance, 401, which requires that the information is relevant to the determination in front of the grand jury at that time. There are other foundational questions that can sometimes be appropriate. I'm trying to think of the number of rules that are out there. I want to say we go from 100 through 900. That doesn't mean there's 900 rules, but they do go in a series where there are a number of other significant things. The most important one I would think would be relevance. You're going to have hearsay. You're going to have privileges such that if you have somebody talking to a doctor or talking to a priest or talking to a lawyer, that information is not admissible at grand jury because it would violate privileges. Those are found in the 500 series. The 400 series all deals with relevance. There's more than just one on relevance. There's inadmissible evidence when it comes to character evidence, which is found in the 600 series. Those are just some of the examples. I'd actually have to pull the rules of evidence to give you an exhaustive list of them all, but that's a quick snippet of them.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
So, Mr. Skidmore, so is it accurate to say that there are a variety of rules and a variety of potential objections that might be made to evidence that would be covered that go substantially beyond hearsay in this one statement that's at the beginning or on in section 12 on page 11, lines 13 and 14?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, the answer is yes. There are other motions that could be filed by the defense after a grand jury proceeding contesting the admissibility of that information or that evidence at trial itself, and therefore questioning the admissibility of that evidence at grand jury.
So, follow up. Mr. Skidmore, so it's accurate to say that this potential rule change that's offered in Section 12 of this legislation goes well beyond hearsay in terms of the matters that would be covered and would be affected if this bill was passed by including the section by the requisite two-thirds.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I'm not sure that I understand that question. Are you asking me if this was passed, would this also eliminate those other evidentiary requirements?
Well, it says evidence which the prosecutor believes would be legally admissible at trial shall be admissible before the grand jury bench here. So, Mr. Skidmore, so this allows in a substantial amount of other evidence in areas that they're potentially objectionable other than hearsay. You mentioned relevance and privileges, for example.
Chair Representative Groh, I don't believe that this would allow that information to be admitted because if the prosecutor believed that was not admissible at trial, it would not be admissible at grand jury.
Okay.
So it's limited to only expanding the ability to summarize evidence, which is what some people will refer to as hearsay.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Skipper, though, I guess my point also then goes to the test. So it's not just hearsay that's covered, as you said, right? But the test is the prosecutor's belief, which I guess I'd understand to be the subjective belief. I mean, if you see what I'm saying, how are we going to, are we opening the door to additional litigation about what was thought, what the prosecutor believed? I'm trying to understand how you think this test would work.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I appreciate that question. No, I don't think this opens up the door any more so than where we are sitting today. So, for example, if you're going to talk about the relevance of a particular piece of evidence, prosecutor presents the grand jury and they think that evidence that the cup was white, or let's assume that's relevant to the crime for whatever reason, believe that that's relevant to the crime, that evidence is admitted, and the defense says, actually, we don't think that that's relevant. The defense in our state, unlike many other states, gets a complete transcript of the grand jury proceeding. They can review all of it. And if they didn't think that the color of the cup was relevant, then they would get to file a motion to find that indictment invalid and to throw it out based on the admission of that irrelevant evidence. And that happens today. That would happen if this passed. So that doesn't change in terms of what's available to the defense.
Follow up? Mr. Skimmer, maybe then you could explain in greater detail what you think these three words, the practical effect these three words mean, the prosecutor believes, in terms of obviously the current law does not include those three words, and then this proposed legislation does. What is the practical effect of that? Please.
Through the chair to Representative Groh, if it's just that the prosecutor believes, that from my standpoint is simply saying the prosecutor believes that this information is admissible and that's why they are presenting it. But that's actually very similar to the language. If you refer to page 10, lines 14 through 16, witnesses may be presented to summarize admissible evidence if admissible evidence will be available at trial. That's the same concept that's currently in the rule, that would still be in the rule, and that's what it's talking about. Adding the word the prosecutor believes up above in line 13 is just to clarify it's the prosecution that is presenting the evidence, and they have to believe that it would be admissible. If they're presenting evidence they didn't think was admissible, they shouldn't be doing that. The three words are to try and help provide clarity, but it's not meant to change substantively the way it would be operating.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Skidmore, I heard through that the court system has their own process for changing their rules, and that although the legislature does do this two-thirds change of a court rule, that generally it's when we've passed a law and legislegal tells us we have to do this too, and that this is different. I'm curious as to why not just have the court system change this law. Or change this procedure for you?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, I appreciate that question, and there's a three-part answer to it. First, when we say that the legislature doesn't typically do this, I would refer you to the hearsay rule itself for the admissibility at grand jury. If you note in Section 12, one of the things that it talks about is the admissibility of an APSIN recording, that is the information in the public safety network about prior convictions that are admissible at grand jury, to try and help streamline grand jury. That is strictly a rule change. That was a rule change that the legislature passed exactly as this one was, that didn't go through that rulemaking process that Ms. Mead described to you, which I agree does exist. Second, I agree that that rulemaking process exists, and I have folks in my division who sit on those committees and partake in that rule changing process. And process is a good word for it because it's a long process. To get anything changed takes multiple years for it to go through that process. And that's the committee that looks at it and is trying to evaluate it, and they argue about it, and you have prosecutors, and you have defense, and you have judges, and they spend a long time on that. They meet three or four times a year, which is accurate, but three or four times a year to try and hash out these discussions is actually not very frequently. And those conversations take a long time. And once they've made the recommendations then go to the Supreme Court that may or may not adopt them. And so when we look at this and we see the change that was implemented in Powell, and we did read that as a change in the law, waiting that period of time to try and change this is problematic for us. We think that it should be changed faster than that period of time. And we believe the legislature is capable of doing that. I told you I had three parts, and now I've forgotten the third part. Those are the two parts that I'm going to stick with.
Follow up.
Here, follow up. Have you proposed this to the committee?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, we have not attempted to take this to the committee. The committee has been tied up with other rules that they're looking at right now. And, you know, I talked to the chair of the committee last year about this, and he had been describing to me the rule that they were looking at the moment, and it had to do with representation of defendants in certain types of cases and the conflicts and whether or not there is a conflict or isn't a conflict. And in proposing something like this, it didn't seem as though that would happen very quickly. And I apologize. I did remember the third part. You had asked about Powell earlier. You know, the Powell case itself says the legislature did not amend the criminal rules governing the admissibility of evidence before the grand jury to allow this type of hearsay to be introduced at the grand jury proceeding, despite the fact that the legislator had previously amended these rules to permit other types of child hearsay statements to be presented to the grand jury. So even the Powell case itself, in the language from the court, directly from them, they're acknowledging if this was a change that you all wanted to be making, you have the ability to make it right here and now. And so when the case itself that calls out for you all to engage in that process, if it's a change you want to have made, to us is an invitation to come back to you all to say, is this truly what you wanted to do? And if so, here's your opportunity to say that. And if you didn't intend to do that, this is also your opportunity to say, nope, actually, we don't want to be making that rule change. But it's an invitation directly in the opinion itself for you all to engage in that process.
Follow up.
Follow up. You mentioned efficiency and a desire for increased efficiency. What percent of the time does the Department of Law get an indictment out of a grand jury?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, the efficiency is certainly a collateral matter to this. It's not the primary goal of it. But in terms of the percentage of time, I'm afraid I don't have that statistic off the top of my head. I have heard from some folks that they think that grand juries return a true bill about 75% of the time that they see them and 25% not. That statistic surprised me. I would have expected it to be higher. I have read statistics from other states where they think they get 98 or 99% true bills or returns of indictments, but I don't have a specific statistic for you that I can cite to. I can just tell you anecdotally those are the things I've heard.
One more follow-up. We have questions from other members.
Okay. I have a couple more, but maybe I can take another bite of the apple later. What other states? You mentioned other states. What other states allow hearsay evidence in a grand jury?
Great question. Arizona, Arkansas, Connecticut, Delaware, the District of Columbia, Hawaii, Kentucky, Maryland, Massachusetts, Mississippi, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Texas, Utah, Vermont, West Virginia, Wyoming, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia.
I have a follow-up.
Right. Representative Carpenter.
Madam Chair, Mr. Skidmore, through the chair, would the proposed court rule change prevent the grand jury from calling the child to testify if the grand jury decided that it was in the best interest of the case?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, absolutely not. The grand jury has the authority to determine what witnesses they want to see in front of it, and they have the ability to subpoena witnesses, and if they wanted to hear from a particular witness, then they can compel that witness to appear.
Okay, thank you. One follow-up. Why is the proposed court rule change not limited to the evidence concerning children, which is inconsistent with what the statute is actually asking? So
sure.
You understand that?
I do. Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, it goes beyond that because as we evaluated making this particular change, we started to do that research, and I quite frankly was surprised when I went and found 30 other jurisdictions that simply allowed summaries of evidence or hearsay, as some people refer to it. And the idea of not just a child victim, but let's talk about an adult victim of sexual assault. An adult victim who has been sexually assaulted, who is giving a statement to law enforcement, and there's actually a similar multidisciplinary team that frequently engages in sexual assault cases. It's called a sexual assault response team. They likewise take statements from adult victims about what's happened to them. Likewise, that statement is then available for admission to grand jury. But if you only changed it for children, you would be saying adult victims need to come in and relive that trauma. And then you can take that beyond simply sex offenses, and you can start to talk about domestic violence cases or other types of violence cases, or though not traumatizing in the same way, let's talk about vehicle theft. If there's a citizen out there who has their car stolen and is inconvenienced by having that car stolen and has to rearrange their life to figure out what they're going to do until they can get the car back or they get it back and they have to deal with whatever condition the car is in, when we call them to grand jury, because we're required to right now, you know what I have to ask them? What's your name? Is that your car? Do you know the person that was caught driving it? Did you give them permission to drive it? Four questions. And yet we had to inconvenience them. They had to take time off of work. They had to take time away from their kids. They had to take time from whatever it is they had going on to come and provide four questions, which they've already told law enforcement. And so from our standpoint, we started saying, is that really the way in which the state wants to approach treating victims in criminal cases? And so we made this proposal for you all to consider, how do you think victims ought to be treated? And it's within your decision-making authority of how you think victims ought to be treated for purposes of grand jury, which again is a determination of, is there probable cause in the evidence that the state has? That's the determination being made. You all get to decide, what do you think victims ought to have to go through in the criminal justice system?
Follow up on that. And I tend to agree with you on the arguments that you've presented here, that it makes procedural sense in the general sense. I guess what I'm also concerned about is whether, do you believe that that grand jury members would have a really good understanding of what would be admissible at trial or not in the context of the information that's being presented by the district attorney and by the law enforcement officer? Is the grand jury really going to know the distinction between what's admissible before trial or not?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, no, I don't believe that most grand jurors do. They are not trained in the law. They're not trained in the rule of evidence. That's why in our state, again, something different than most other states, we record the entire grand jury process other than deliberations. And that recording is provided, a transcript provided to the defense to review that. Again, the defense in this situation is legally trained, does have all of that background and understands the rules of evidence. And if they think there was something improper about it, they get to file motions today. If this change were passed, they get to file motions still about, we think there was evidence that wasn't admissible, that should be excluded. And then that's ultimately decided by a judge. Also, again, legally trained to determine whether or not that should have occurred. So do grand jurors know? In my experience, typically no. I would acknowledge occasionally you'll get a lawyer on a grand jury who might have some information about that. But by and large, the answer is no. But there is a process set up for that additional review to occur.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. At the point in time in which the defense attorney is brought into this situation, this hypothetical situation, the arrest has already been made, the indictment has already been issued, and the arrest has already been made.
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, that is typically the case. However, it's not always the case. And the reason I say it that way is that it is possible for someone to have been indicted without having previously been arrested. And depending on whether or not that person had an arrest warrant issued for them or whether or not it was a summons, the person may not have been. So it's, you are correct, that's typically the way it occurs, but it's not exclusively that way.
Follow up?
Yeah, let me ponder on this for a minute, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Chair. I'm looking at page 9 of the bill, and it's referencing some statutes which are being added to the definition of sex offense. And it's possible this book in front of me is outdated, but I think the section being referred to is indecent viewing of a picture. To what extent are we making indecent viewing of a picture a sex offense? I'm looking specifically at line 4 on page 9.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, you're not. Section 9 is the definition of domestic violence. And
page 9.
I'm sorry. Section 8, page?
Page 9, line 4.
9, line 4. So line 4 is not one that is bold and underlined. It, so it's not anything that's changing. It's what's already in statute.
Okay. I'm just looking at the bolded portion of line 4.
I'm sorry, section?
Page 9.
Page 9.
Line 4.
I'm sorry, I was on page 8. My mistake. So here we're in the definition of sex offense, and you're on line 4, and the offender is subject to... So Alaska Statute 1161-123-F1 or 2 is changed to 1161-123-G1 or 2, and I would have to go back and specifically look at that statute to tell you the difference there, or, you know, we sort of skipped over the sectional analysis today, and that might actually be helpful to your answer. Ms. Schroeder is here and can do a sectional analysis for you all and might be able to provide some details about that for you.
Thank you. Follow up? You had made a comment earlier dealing with the requirement of whether or not to have a younger victim appear before a grand jury. And you had mentioned, I think, that we're now giving an option for that testimony to come to the grand jury via recording, as opposed to requiring the prosecutor to present the witness before the grand jury, but that there's still the opportunity for the prosecutor to do either, I suppose, but nothing here is going to preclude the prosecutor from bringing a witness in person. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, you have that correct.
Follow up. I understand that may be legally true, but is that going to be practically the case? You know, as we are creating this opportunity based on a recognition that we don't want to re-victimize a victim, mm-hmm. It might be legally true, but become politically, professionally, maybe not so true if you're, as a prosecutor, having to contend with criticism potentially that you re-victimize the victim now and you had this other option. We're creating this other option now, but we're also, I think, allowing for victim advocates, the public at large, others to now criticize a prosecutor anytime they bring, you know, a young victim before a grand jury.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I appreciate that concern. I will, excuse me, I will tell you that as a prosecutor for 25 years, I've learned that our job is subject to criticism no matter what we do. One side always thinks we're too harsh. Another side always thinks we haven't done enough. I don't think any change that we make protects us from not being criticized. What I will say in response to your question is you are suggesting that prosecutors might not call in a victim just because they were afraid of that criticism. I will respectfully disagree with you. I have talked with folks in my department who believe that there are cases that it will still be vitally important for a grand jury to assess the credibility of someone. And if they believe that to be the case, they would still intend to call those individuals to grand jury. What this change does is it allows prosecutors in those cases in which they don't think that credibility is something that the jury needs to be worried about, or that they think the jury can accurately assess that credibility from the video recording that they might play, it gives them the option to do that instead of having to call that person in. So do I think this is going to chill prosecutors? No. We're always subject to criticism, and I guess I've learned that over 25 years.
Thank you very much.
So I'm just wanting to take a look at the at this hearsay and clarify. So we're allowing the option for a law enforcement to summarize a recording by a witness. Is that accurate?
To the chair, you're allowing law enforcement to summarize either a recording or a statement that isn't recorded, that typically are recorded, but I want to be clear, it allows an officer to summarize statements made to the officer.
So if in this case would a record, the recording and or transcript also be provided? Because sometimes a summary is like playing the game of telephone.
Sure.
And important things get left out. And that's kind of where my concern is. Will the actual words be provided along with the summary in consideration?
To the chair, either version would be acceptable as this is drafted currently. I can't tell you how every prosecutor would approach it in a sexual abuse or a sexual assault case. If I was the prosecutor, I would elect to have the video recording of the transcript because I agree with exactly what you've said. We often want to review the recorded statement and not simply rely on the summary. On the flip side, if I'm dealing with that vehicle theft case, am I going to present the transcript of that recording? Probably not. I'm probably going to have the officer summarize it. So it's going to depend on the type of case, in the significance and the importance of each word uttered, as to how a prosecutor might approach it.
So with that is, I mean, the recommendation seems like a very, you're using a very broad brush.
Yes.
And can you, why did you choose to use the broad brush rather than being more prescriptive? Because we're dealing with very different things when you're talking about, you know, vehicle theft versus,
yes,
you know, sexual assault cases. And I think from what I'm hearing is that there's concern about the impacts of that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you walk us through why you came to that decision to just go with a broad approach?
To the chair, we conducted that survey of all the other states and looked at how they approach this and what do they do. That broad brush approach that you described is what's used in 30 other states and, excuse me, by 29 other states and the federal government. So when we look at that, we say that's the most common approach. That's the majority approach in our country today in how they're addressing these issues. And so that was the approach that we chose to follow. Is it possible to try and carve that up and create different rules for different types of cases? If that's the approach that the legislature wanted to take, I certainly think that that's possible. We simply try to follow what it seems like most other legal jurisdictions in our country are doing currently.
Thank you for that. I know it is now 2:20. I know we have a lot more questions for Mr. Skidmore. I would like to have Ms. Casey Schroeder come and give us a sectional so that we can have that bigger picture of this in the first introduction through looking at each section, and then we can continue with any further questions as time allows.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General at the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I will run through the sectional, and Representative Eastman, I will be able to answer your question when we get to that section. Section 1 is the legislative findings and intent section, and both of those subsections relate to the Powell case, and that those sections have already been discussed with the committee. Section 2 pertains to stalking, and Mr. Skidmore described how we are including violation of a stalking and sexual assault protective order in the crime of stalking in the first degree. So if you have a stalking protective order against you and you continue to stalk someone, that is going to be stalking in the first degree. Section 3, the substantive change there is on page 3. That is the consecutive sentencing for violating conditions of release. And it just says that some additional time needs to be imposed for each additional crime of violating conditions of release for which the person is receiving a sentence. Sections 4 through 7 all pertain to additional information that sex offenders need to provide to the Department of Public Safety. And it includes things like job title, physical address of their employer, the registration for watercraft, aircraft, anything that they might own like that. So it's just general basic information, additional information that needs to go to the Department of Public Safety. And skipping on to Section 8, this is the definition of sex offense. Any crime in this definition is considered a registrable sex offense, and there are new crimes added to that definition. And that most of those changes are in page 9. I would note that the change on page 8 is a cleanup change. It's just a correcting a drafting error. Section 9 is where we find the list of crimes. I would note that page 9, line 4, as asked by Representative Eastman, that is a cleanup. The indecent viewing crime is already registrable. The legislature made it registrable in 2019, but there was an error in the cross-reference. So the cross-reference that's in current law is F1 or 2, and if you look at that those subsections, that doesn't relate to a crime. It talks about other things. So we need to reference back to a crime because we're making a crime registrable. So we're changing that cross-reference to G1 or 2, which identifies the B felony or C felony level offense in that crime as being registrable. So we're just correcting that cross-reference. The next crime that's listed is sexual penetration with a corpse. So that would be a registrable sex offense. And then the other crimes listed there are sex trafficking 1 and 2. Section 9 amends the definition of domestic violence or crime involving domestic violence. And the substantive change there is on page 10, towards the top of the page. We are adding interfering with the report of a crime involving domestic violence, that is an actual crime in itself. But that crime would only be a crime of domestic violence if the person who is interfering with the report of the crime of domestic violence was the person that actually committed the underlying crime of domestic violence. So I hope I didn't, that's a little circular, but that's what that language is doing. We're also adding unlawful contact as a crime of domestic violence. And again, it would only be a crime of domestic violence if it meets the other definitions of being a household member and having that special relationship. This is not any unlawful contact that would be a domestic violence crime. Section 10 is the Child Advocacy Center section, allowing them to interview when the perpetrator is under 13, so that they would be able to interview both the victim and the perpetrator. Section 11 pertains to requiring sex offenders from out of state to also who have to register to also register in Alaska when they get to Alaska. Section 12 is the grand jury court rule change. Section 13, on page 12, is the repealer section. And it repeals AS 1240.110. That statute relates to out-of-court statements made by children at grand jury. And since the way the court rule change is drafted, that all out-of-court statements could be admissible, that statute is no longer necessary, so it's being repealed. Section 14 is the applicability section. And there are several different things happening here. On page 13, subsection A of the applicability section talks about the new crimes, and the new crimes are going to be applied prospectively. The information relating to sex offender registry, so the physical address of where their employer is, things like that, those changes are going to apply to people who are currently on the registry. So anybody currently on or on later, those requirements are going to apply to. Subsection E on line 16 on page 13 pertains to the new crimes that are added to be a registrable sex offense, and that is going to be applied prospectively. Subsection F pertains to the court rule change, and that would apply to indictments occurring on or after the effective date. Section 15 is the conditional effect, which is required for the court rule change. And Section 16 is the effective date, and the effective date would be July 1, 2023.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. Any questions by committee members? Representative Eastman.
For Mr. Skidmore?
For Ms. Schroeder. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Representative Eason, you have a question.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm particularly looking right now on page 6, line 30.
Page 6, line 30. Okay.
And it doesn't look like this is changing a ton here, but there is a change. And so I'm wondering, why are we going from year to period? What's the rationale there?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, for the record, this is John Skidmore, and the answer to the question is, when it was told for a year, you could have somebody that was not in compliance for a period of maybe a month. And in that 1 month, for not having been in compliance, we were then extending the registration time for a full year. This is really just indicating for that period that you were not in compliance, that's how long the registry is being extended. So just for 1 month in that situation. So it's just trying to make it more equitable and fair to individuals that are on the registry.
Okay. Thank you. Follow up. And then on page five, section six, the new section being added.
Yes.
Where we've got some rather detailed requirements. If a sex offender or child kidnapper plans to leave the state, I guess for any period of time, they have to make notification at least 7 calendar days before leaving the state. There's another requirement where they have to make notification at least 21 days before leaving the state for any time they leave the United States. So if someone were to try and leave Juneau and drive to Anchorage, they would be leaving not only the state but the country. And so this new requirement would require them to know at least 21 days ahead of time that they were planning on doing that and make some notification at least 21 days before they could do that legally. What's the reason for that and how is that supposed to work?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the concept there is about individuals that are leaving the country, and it's not typical. Alaska may be a little different in that regard, because most times if you're leaving the country, you're not in the state leaving the country to get to another part of the state. But the challenge or the risk there tends to be for the individuals that, for example, would travel to someplace in the Far East where they may be able to engage in sexual acts with children over there. And the idea is for them to have to give notice to us so that we can then comply with treaties that we have with other countries to be able to notify them when a sex offender may be coming into their country. And in terms of leaving the state, where it's not necessarily just where it's not the country, but just the state going from one state to another, it's the idea of being able to communicate with our sister states about when folks are traveling in those circumstances.
Follow up?
Yeah. And so is it the intention of the state then to, I guess, notify any number of states that an individual is planning on traveling to or through? Or are we just collecting this information and then we may or may not, you know, have expend the effort to make notifications like you mentioned?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, in getting into those other specific details, we have Lisa Purrington from the Department of Public Safety here that has helped manage the sex offender registry in the past. I could take a wag at it, but you're probably better off asking her some of those questions, since it'd be her shop that would be responsible for doing those sorts of things.
Excellent. Thank you.
Before we have her come up, we do have another member has a question for
okay.
you. So Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I said Co-Chair, Madam Chair. I don't know where that came from. Mr. Skidmore, through the chair. Back to the admissibility of evidence court rule change mm-hmm. question. Mm-hmm. You had stated that the grand jury has the right to gather information that they see fit. They even have the right to subpoena to yes. gather whatever information they see fit. So that's pretty broad authority. And I don't want to quote you, but that's the general concept
we yes.
discussed earlier.
Yes.
With this court rule change, could evidence that the prosecutor believes would not be admissible at trial be withheld from the grand jury?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, the prosecutor, let me give you an example. In grand juries that I've conducted, and I've had witnesses that are there, and I have grand jurors are entitled to ask questions of the witnesses. And when they ask the questions of the witnesses, if the question that they are asking, I hear the question and I think, that's inadmissible, they can't ask that question, I'll stop the witness from answering. I'll tell the grand juror, I'm sorry, I'm not going to let them answer, and I'll explain why. I'll explain to them the rule, the evidentiary ruling, and my analysis of why I don't think they could answer that particular question. All of that analysis is preserved then for defense attorneys and judges later on to decide if did they disagree with me? Did they think that was admissible for some reason? And in terms of evidence that prosecutors had looked at presenting, we as prosecutors would not ask or submit evidence that we thought was inadmissible. If the grand jurors are asking for evidence, then it would be my expectation that any prosecutor would be explaining to the grand jury, if information's not allowed, why it's not being allowed, and provide them with that evidentiary ruling. Because again, that's the sort of thing that's subject to review by defense counsel or a judge. So the difference in terms of what you say, not being made available to them, if it's just my analysis of the case file and I decide not to present something, I'm not telling the grand jury everything that I've looked at in the case file, every piece of evidence that I'm not admitting to them, I would not do that. But if the grand jurors are specifically asking for it, then I believe they're entitled to know why that information would not be presented to them, and we would be required to give them an evidentiary reason for it.
Follow up?
I guess the question that I would have, how would the grand jury know that the evidence was even there to ask the question about if it wasn't brought to the attention by the prosecuting attorney? How would they even know? I mean, they would have to go through a logical line of questioning to arrive at the position where they maybe stumbled upon the information that was not known, but the prosecuting attorney had already made a decision that it wasn't admissible. And I guess the follow-on question to that would then be, who makes a decision of whether something is admissible at trial?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, grand juries are not a situation in which we are simply turning over our case file to the members of the grand jury and they read literally everything in it. It frequently contains information that's not admissible at trial. That's part of what we have to do as lawyers for the public, is we are given the obligation of reviewing that information, applying that legal training to what we see in front of us, and then advising folks accordingly. Having said that, my experience with grand juries over the years is they are fairly inquisitive and intuitive, and they will ask all sorts of questions, some that I could have anticipated, some that I never would have anticipated. Either way, it's my responsibility and obligation to advise them of what the law is and why something would or wouldn't be admissible. When it is admissible, then they get to hear it. In terms of who's the ultimate arbiter of that sort of information, the answer is the courts. Whatever we do in grand jury is ultimately reviewed by a court. It would not go to the court absent a defense attorney raising an objection to it. So if the defense looks at it and thinks we haven't done anything improper, there's no reason for the courts to be reviewing it, because the system's set up in that adversarial system, the prosecution on one side and the defense on the other. And if both of those folks are saying, yeah, this is okay, there's no reason for the courts to have to then get involved and do this micromanagement of what had occurred there. But in any situation in which a defense attorney says, no, I disagree with the legal analysis, the legal reasoning, they would file a motion. That would go in front of the court, and the court would make that determination. And if the court rules against the defense, then they have a subsequent opportunity to take that to an appellate court, right? We're going back to that criminal justice system 101 that we talked about a number of weeks ago.
And I understand that. I think we're getting the cart before the horse just a little bit, because I'm talking about what happens prior to an indictment even being issued.
Okay.
Okay, so I asked the question, who determines what evidence is admissible in trial, and that is the judge.
Yes.
The follow-on question then is, who determines what evidence is admissible before the grand jury?
Again, the way through the chair to Representative Carpenter, again, the way that would work is that the prosecution, having received that legal training, would look at what evidence do I think needs to be presented to meet the elements of the crime that the grand jury has to consider. I'm going to select that evidence. I'm going to present that to the grand jury. I'm making that determination based on my training and experience, which is then subject to review by defense counsel, and if they think we've done something improper, to then to the court. So at grand jury, the prosecution's making that initial evaluation, but it's subject to that subsequent review to see whether or not that evaluation is disagreed with.
Follow up.
Thank you. I guess what I need to understand is, what is the constitutional authority or the statutory authority that enables the prosecuting attorney to make a decision as to what information is not presentable to a grand jury because it might be inadmissible in court, given all sorts of experience levels on mm-hmm. prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
If the ultimate decision as to whether something is admissible or not after the indictment is in the hands of the court and only in the court, then why is prior to an indictment the ability to withhold information from the grand jury or decide that it's not admissible mm-hmm. in the hands of the prosecutor?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, the prosecutor is required by statute to bring cases forward to the grand jury, and the prosecutor has the obligation set out from various ethics rules and other case law to present the information to the grand jury. And a prosecutor is going to want to present as much information as they think is necessary to move that case forward to the next stage, which is the trial. To suggest that someone other than the prosecutor would be making that determination would be to fundamentally change the system as it's designed to instead, if the courts have to decide that, prosecutors wouldn't be prosecuting the cases. You'd be in a French system of justice where the judge, the court personnel are deciding what information is then going to go in front of juries. But there's ultimately someone who has to make that initial determination. In our system, it's set up where the prosecution carries the burden of proof. They're selecting the information that they think is going to help meet that burden of proof. That can then be challenged by the defense. And if there are disagreements, the courts are the ultimate arbiters of what it should be. But to start the process, someone has to have made that initial screening, and it's the prosecutor.
And I guess I follow, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I follow the whole French courts piece of this. But I'm keen in on the prosecutor believes piece of this because I'm not entirely sure that in all cases that a grand jury knows exactly the questions that they need to ask, and that if there is information that the prosecutor believes doesn't need to come before the grand jury, then the prosecutor with this court rule change has the discretion to not bring it before the grand jury. Because it is specifically stating that the prosecutor believes that it would be legally admissible, which is a judgment call on the prosecuting attorneys and only the prosecuting attorneys. So if a grand jury has the constitutional authority mm-hmm. to all information, regardless of whether it's admissible at court or not, and that is a Article I constitutional right, not a subset of the executive, judiciary, or legislative constitutional authority. It is an individual and collective right of the people of Alaska to have all information brought before them in a grand jury. Why would we be granting the power to the prosecutor to choose what is admissible and what is not to the grand jury?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, I'm afraid I disagree with your assessment that a grand jury has a right to any and all information to be brought in front of them. That's not the case. That's never been the case. When a grand jury is evaluating evidence to determine whether or not to issue an indictment, they're only supposed to be looking at what is admissible evidence. That's always the way that that's worked. And the Constitution, I would respectfully disagree with you, doesn't say contrary to that. If it did say something contrary to that, that would be a situation in which a grand jury could say, I want to determine whether or not somebody was using drugs. And to make that determination, I want to know about all their prior drug use. That's not admissible. That's not relevant. That would violate the rules of evidence. And if that information was admitted at a trial, that conviction would be overturned. If that information was admitted at a grand jury, that grand jury would be overturned. So they're not entitled to all information that's there and that's available. They're entitled to information admissible at court. And so there's a lawyer that then is the advisor to the grand jury. All grand juries have legal advisors to them that are helping them parse through what information they should be considering and what's the type of information they should not. If a grand juror were to ask that question, I'd like to know about this person's previous drug use, I as a prosecutor would say, well, I understand that might be of interest to you. The rules of evidence don't make that relevant to this particular determination. You have to make this decision based on the information in front of you of this specific instance, not this prior conduct. So I guess I'm not necessarily accepting the premise that you describe that the grand jury is entitled to any and all information out there, because I don't think that's the way it's set up.
Is there a statute or some statutory authority that is leading you to this conclusion, or is this just how we've always done it?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, I think that that answer is probably going to be based on a compilation of case law and statutes and rules. I can sit down and try and find some specific authority for you to help you with that, but that's sort of one of those things that, having been through law school and now practice for 25 years, that's readily apparent to me, and I would need to sit down and go through to pick out the precise statutes or rules that I think direct that. But I'm confident in that answer, and I'm happy to sit down with you and try and give you that additional authority.
I'll hold my questions for later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. I think helping us understand, you live and breathe this, but we do not. And understanding all of the court rules and the process is very helpful as we deliberate on this. Now, we have 9 minutes left, and we did have a question hanging for DPS, but I wanted to find out, Representative Eastman, you did have a question for Mr. Skidmore, or would you like to pivot to DPS? Okay, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and just to follow up through the chair. So you have grand juries who are following the process you've outlined. We all are somewhat familiar with that at this point, I think. You also have expectations that if a member of a grand jury, you know, comes into possession of evidence of a crime, that there's an obligation to report that or make that available. You have requests that come before grand juries to perform an investigative function. What I see here in this language is that none of that can move forward until you find a prosecutor to sign off on that. And I don't see any exception, which is somewhat surprising to me. Is there an exception out there somewhere that, I mean, I'm kind of following the same concern from my colleague here. If we pass this law, we're now locking down that information from whatever source cannot come before a grand jury until a prosecutor signs off on it. Did I understand that right?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, this bill isn't changing that portion of the process. When you're asking me, does evidence get screened by a prosecutor before it goes to a grand jury, the answer is yes, it does get screened. And this bill doesn't change that in any way, shape, or form. That's what happens now. That's what would happen after this. If you're asking me, is there an exception for that? The closest that I could come to an exception is where the grand juror asks a question in grand jury, and then they are advised what the rules of evidence are that would or wouldn't admit that particular piece of evidence. If you're asking me about trying to initiate a grand jury, that's a separate concept and a separate question. And there was a recent amendment of Criminal Rule 6.1 by the Alaska Supreme Court that dealt with investigative grand juries. So that's a different conversation than what we're having here about what evidence is admissible. But this bill doesn't change the role that the prosecutor plays in evaluating the evidence to go before the grand jury.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. So, follow up. You mentioned 30 jurisdictions.
Yes.
Don't allow or allow hearsay at grand juries. Of those jurisdictions, which one of them are their citizens? Do the citizens have a constitutional right to a grand jury?
Constitutional right to a grand jury. Through the chair to Representative Gray, are you asking me which states have a constitutional requirement that a grand jury indict before a case moves to trial? Okay. So I can't tell you all of them, but I can tell you that Ohio is one of them. I can tell you that Hawaii is one of them. And there's another one. Give me just a second. I'm sorry, Texas. So Ohio, Texas, and Hawaii all have that. Oregon is another state that also does require a grand jury for a case to move forward to trial, but Oregon does not allow summaries, does not allow hearsay like what we've talked about here. So that's Oregon's a state that's like Alaska now, but Ohio, Texas, and Hawaii all have those same constitutional requirements, and they all allow hearsay.
Follow up. This launches a little bit off of Chair Vance's line of questioning a moment ago. When you came and visited my office, which I really appreciate, to talk about the bill, mm-hmm. we talked about the importance of not re-traumatizing children.
Yes.
I understand today, though, that it is broader, and we also don't want to inconvenience the victims of vehicle theft. And in thinking about that, I was thinking, it's a hypothetical, I'm not a lawyer, but if you have like a 19-year-old who was at his parents' house and they're out of town and the dad says, don't drive my car, and he drives the car and crashes it, walks home, he knows the guy across the street, drinks himself to sleep, he decides he's going to get himself out of trouble by saying his car was stolen. Let's say that he thinks that he saw the guy across the street walking back, the police find the guy, is unable to arouse him. In this hypothetical, they want to charge this man with stealing this car. And we don't want to inconvenience that 19-year-old, I get it, to have to go to a grand jury. But isn't it more of an inconvenience for somebody to be on trial for a crime they didn't commit?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I feel like I'm back in law school with hypotheticals. Your question to me, do we want to charge people who haven't committed a crime with a crime? The answer is no. The hypothetical that you've presented to me of a 19-year-old taking their parents' car and then trying to blame that on another person, and somehow that other person ends up being charged, I would submit to you, if that's going to happen, that's going to happen whether you change this rule or not, if that 19-year-old is coming to grand jury and testifying that way. So really, that's going to be about the investigation. This bill isn't changing that in any way. What the bill does is it says that information can be summarized, but your point about someone being charged with a crime they didn't commit is really about the quality of the investigation.
Follow up. So, and I get it. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not good with hypotheticals. But a 19-year-old at 2 in the morning might make some bad decisions.
Sure.
But when they're under oath and they see somebody possibly being charged for something that they did, they may decide to tell the truth. And in that particular case, they might come before a grand jury and say, I'm sorry. I did this. I'm sorry. I know that's never happened. Maybe people don't get charged for crimes they don't commit. I'm not an expert on this, but I think the grand jury might be a place where we could prevent somebody from being charged from a crime that they didn't commit. And I have a fear about, even though it might be inconvenient for victims of car theft to have to come before a grand jury, that in some cases it might be helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So through the chair, Representative Gray, I appreciate that. As I think about your hypothetical, it's going to be the owner of the vehicle that would have to be called in to say that someone didn't have permission. I haven't quite sorted through the hypothetical of how we found the homeless person across the street that is being targeted.
Please delete the hypothetical, sir. I don't know how to do a hypothetical.
Okay.
But I think I wanted a hypothetical where somebody didn't commit the crime. But it was only hearsay. Somebody gave a statement to the police and said he did it, and the police are the only people. They go and they're like, he said he did it. We don't need to inconvenience that person and have them come here and say that this guy did it. He told me he did it. That's all you need to hear. We don't need to swear that guy in. He doesn't need to say under oath that guy did it. I'm the police officer. I know what I heard.
Got it. I appreciate that. And what I would tell you is that in the Department of Law, our role, our standard for our folks is that we don't charge crimes unless we believe we can prove them beyond a reasonable doubt. And I appreciate that you're struggling to find a hypothetical that tries to illustrate a point you're trying to make. The only response that I can have for you is, I'm not sure that the grand jury process protects against a faulty investigation. We would be looking for that amount of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that somebody had committed the crime. And I really don't think that this bill is changing that. I understand the point you're making, but I just respectfully disagree. I don't think the grand jury changes that.
Follow up. It's really fast.
No, it is 3:00. We have run out of time for this committee. We will hear this bill again. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore, Ms. Schroeder, for introducing us to HB 67. We are going to set it aside. That concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Monday, March 6th at 1:30 p.m. to take up amendments and consider passage of House Bill 66. After that, the committee will hear House Bill 82, Selection and Review of Judges, by Representative Rauscher in its first hearing. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It is 3 p.m.